You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 251. Not a good week if you have money stashed away in Panama, but are we all being guilty of double standards? Now, unless you're Ben Stokes, the 2020 World Cup was a huge success. But is it killing all other forms of cricket? Oh, and ring the bells, hoist the flags, Dermot and the X Factor are reunited. Anyway, that's all coming up after Belle and Sebastian and Perfect Couples.
From their most recent album, Girls in Peacetime Want to Dance, a splendid choice by Juliette, Belle and Sebastian, and Perfect Couples. Hello, welcome to the Media Motel podcast, 251, episode 251. Mm-hmm. I'm Terence Stackham, and here's the, wait for this, Jules, here's the Belle of East Sussex.
You're too kind. This is almost as good as the anagrams as far as introductions go. And thank you. I'm glad you.
Another Gary Davis, Pat Sharp style.
Yes, indeed. Ooh, Juliette Harris. Yes, indeed. I very much was glad that you enjoyed the Belle and Sebastian, by the way. My favourite thing about that is, you know, when you get earworms sometimes when you can't get certain songs out of your head, I get earworm phrases from songs. So I get certain lines which are sort of hyper specific earworms. And the line, restaurant after dark, I've been very taken with. Restauranting as a verb is something I've always been a big fan of. Nostalging as a verb, but I think that restauranting as a verb is going to be something, yes, that, you know. So I'm sorry, I can't do the podcast tonight, Terence. I'm out restauranting.
I like that. Mm. I think I'm going to use that. That's really good. Jules, this hasn't been a good week for anyone holding a position of public responsibility, no, and who also happens to have their savings.
Yes, any kind of assets at all. Yes, indeed.
Particularly if you've got them secreted away in Panama. Mm. The story of the Panama Papers, it's bubbled along all week. And I have a feeling, and I think you do too, that there are more questions, or perhaps even the same question, to be answered by, in particular, politicians, and especially Mr. Cameron and Mr. Osborne, who both seem to be choosing their words with extreme, yes, care, yes, when they face difficult questions about tax avoidance at the moment. But before we all get too full of ourselves in our moral outrage, doesn't everyone contribute to tax avoidance? I was thinking, when the plumber says he'll knock 20 quid off if you pay him cash, and of course, anybody listening to this, if you sell stuff on eBay or at car boot sales, do you let HMRC know that you've earned additional income? We're all in tax avoidance together, Jules.
Yes, well, you say this. I do see your point. Yes, that is tax avoidance. Depending, of course, upon a number of factors specific to your own personal tax situation, which is a bit like Personal Jesus by Depeche Mode, except infinitely more dull. Again, depending on whether you like Depeche Mode. But yes,
some accountants might find the subject absolutely riveting.
Indeed, yes, and hooray for them, and indeed the many boats in which I suspect they sail. It depends, of course, about how your personal allowance position, you know, your income tax position, that sort of thing. So yes, you might not have to pay on your car boot sale. Those of us who like selling their records at car boot sales, we may or may not be doing porridge at some point in the future, depending on our own tax positions. I think I broadly agree with you that, yes, you know, everyone sort of does it to a degree. But having said that, I think there's a bit of a, I think, like all crime, I think it's on a sliding scale. For example, the fact that when I was at secondary school, we had our, I don't know what it's called now, it might be called PSHE now. It was personal and social education when I was younger, which is basically that bit in form time, which I didn't really know how to fill. And you know, various serious issues of the day were waltzed through in an hour. That by far the best day was the day when the community police officer came in and took a 10-inch machete out of his briefcase. It was wonderful, particularly for the look on our form tutor's face, who I suspect realised that she'd chosen the wrong career at that point. And did in fact leave 4 months later, so I wonder if that was the butterfly that flapped its wings in her life. But we had one about crime, and we were given six potential crimes, and we were told we were given six potential sentences, and we were told, and it was about drugs, and we were told, you know, what sentence did we think went with which crime. And I remember the least serious was the 20 year old student that had been stopped with an eighth of an ounce of cannabis for her own personal use, and the most serious was the businessman who'd been stopped on a flight from Colombia with a briefcase with a false bottom that had 10 grand's worth of cocaine in it. And for me here, this feels a little bit like the person at the car boot sale is your student with their eighth of an ounce of cannabis for personal use. And your people in Panama are quite literally the businessman with the suitcase with the false bottom with 10 grand's worth of cocaine in it. I do think it's a question of degree. I do think that, you know, perhaps not telling HMRC that your plumber's let you have 20 quid off because it's cash is not exactly the same thing as putting all
adds up.
But not quite as excessively as putting all of your millions of personal tax funds into a myriad tax avoidance. Well, we can talk about tax avoidance and tax evasion and the differences between until the cows come home. Mm. But for me, one leads to the other. But I suppose if we want to go back to earlier, it's a gateway drug, I feel, really. If you are avoiding tax, at some point you fall over into evading it, I think. And for me, you know, yes, it all adds up, but equally it doesn't add up. It would take an awful lot of £20 from plumbers to add up to these myriad labyrinthian tax avoidance, tax evasion, however you want to slice it, type schemes, which people who have been elected into governments in positions of power, who, if you are doing those kind of positions, you're in those kind of positions, doing those kind of roles, you have a high standard that you have to adhere to than everyone else, because that's how it is. I think that's an altogether different thing. As we talk this evening, the 7th of April, Thursday the 7th of April, as we're recording, in the last couple of hours, we've had this news story that's been kind of bubbling. Well, with the Panama revelations have been starting since Sunday. At this point in time, there's been questions this week about David Cameron's father being involved in this.
And to what? Blair Moore Holdings.
Yes, indeed. Isn't it funny that they're named after Blair? That's tickled me all week, I must admit, because I am a nerd. But it's interesting that Cameron's had repeated questions about to what extent he personally has benefited, and has said that it's a private matter and that sort of thing. And
that didn't wash at all.
No, the people would, weirdly enough, people weren't having that. And it's trickled on all week. And then now, within the last 2 hours, he'd said yesterday in this morning that they did not presently and would not in the future benefit, to which the question came from everyone with a brain, all that misses out the past, doesn't it? What happened in the past? And David Cameron has been quoted as saying that he did have shares in Blair Moore. He says we, by which I assume he means him and his wife, did have shares in this Blair Moore Holdings, which they sold in January 2015. No, sorry, that's wrong.
2010,
yes, apologies. I still think that's relevant. But anyway, January 2010, so less than 6 months before he was elected Prime Minister, at a time when he'd been the leader of the Conservatives for a number of years and was presenting himself by that point as the leader of the government in waiting, a.k.a. the opposition. Remember those days when the opposition was a government in waiting. And he said, well, I sold them at that point in January before he became Prime Minister, and they got £30,000 out of it. Firstly, a little part of me rankles at the fact that that is presented as if it is shortchange, which, you know, it's about, you know, it's quite a large portion of my annual salary, frankly, that. So now I think this is my, I'm going to go on from tax avoidance to my theory now. This is okay. Got a bit of a theory. This could be right, this could be wrong, because, you know, trying to predict politics is like trying to predict the weather sometimes. But equally, there are patterns in weather and there are patterns in politics that I think we can predict. People think we're living through a time of new politics, and I'm not entirely convinced. I think the old politics won resoundingly in May 2015. So, if this, I think, rather than start, the age-old truism is that if you are a story for a week, a negative scandal story for a week, you are gone. We talked about Cheryl Gillan, remember her, ages ago, and she was a story for a week and went, and the pattern is always the same, and that's what happened to Liam Fox. That's what, I mean, this lot are quite unusual in that they don't tend to resign. Jeremy Hunt probably should have resigned twice and hasn't, but equally, you know, some of them do, bless their hearts, they do sometimes. So rather than starting the clock ticking from Sunday, which is when the paper started to come in, I'm going to start our countdown clock. Our David Cameron countdown clock starts now at 20 past eight on Thursday the 7th of April. If we are all still talking about this and it has not gone away and we are still talking about David Cameron's family tax affairs by this time next week, next Friday, we will find out that either he has offered his resignation or a vote of no confidence has been called. Which means then, and this is the butterfly flapping its wings. I thought previously that Britain would probably vote by a smallish margin to stay in the EU, because I applied the same rules to this as to what happened in Scotland, which is that people who are out of Scotland and people that were sort of yes in Scotland and out in the EU are always going to be louder, because it's sexier and more exciting to be against the establishment, isn't it? That is, you know, that you're a cool renegade, man. You know, that is, you're a Corbynista, you know, everyone's against you and you're right and hooray. Except most people don't really, you know, as we learned at the 2015 election, quite a lot of people are in the middle by and large. And generally speaking, if you're in the middle, you know, by and large, you tend to plump for the status quo. And that's what happened in, you know, in Scotland, and that's what happened in the general election. People plumped for the status quo. So I thought that probably, you know, the quote unquote common sense or middle of the road, however you want to slice it, view would be that we'd stay in. I think if David Cameron, the combination of David Cameron going, general upset about international affairs, and also this £9 million being spent on leaflets to by the government, which I, you know, I'm a passionate in person. Ironically, given the aspects of my lifestyle, I'm passionately in for the EU. I really.
So you're in the closet.
I know.
You're in.
I know. For once, you know, for once, I've gone back in for a bit because I, you know, I passionately we should stay in the EU. We could talk about that another time, but. Even though I think that is massively, massively ill-advised that, you know, the government is basically spending £9 million of public money telling people to stay in. I think previously, I think it might have worked, to be honest. But the combination of all those things means, I don't know what sequence these events will go, but I think that plausibly we could end up voting for Brexit now, I think. Again, by not a massive majority, but it wouldn't surprise me if the wind swung that way. I suspect that if we fight a general election, I can't see the Labour. If there was a general election this year, I can't see the Labour Party fighting it with anybody other than Jeremy Corbyn, because I just don't think enough people would vote him out. Which means we'll have Jeremy Corbyn versus the Conservative candidate. If the disgraced Cameron has gone, and actually, if he's still a news story after 7 days, despite the fact that that is the rule that people usually go by then, him and Osborne are not popular in the Conservative Party at the moment. He doesn't have a phalanx of loyal MPs who'd be rushing to save him and a phalanx of grandees, which means for me, the Tories will fight any general election we have this year, which if Cameron goes, we will do, with either... Either everyone gets behind a sensible choice like Theresa May or senior Boris Johnson comes to save the day. Forget Osborne. He's finished. He's gone. You know, he's had it, which means plausibly Boris could be PM by Christmas. I think that this might be a butterfly.
Interesting theory.
That's how Panamanian butterfly may yet affect us in Britain, I feel.
I mean, mentioning Boris, I mean, there are, of course... There's the breathtaking double standards of politicians to take into account here. And Mr. Cameron and Mr. Osborne seem to be, this week, have been intent on, until the last few years, have been intent on taking the sort of Boris Johnson route of blustering and repeating the same non-answer.
Or the Eton boys is, together, yes.
Yes, yeah, indeed. The hope, there's a story that I... Boris has succeeded in this over years, in that hoping that the story dies away or is overtaken on news bulletins and in newspapers by world events. That's right.
One of Linton Crosby's dead cats.
Yes, exactly. Editors, in the end, just regard a story as getting rather stale, or some awful event happens somewhere in the world, and then, like Houdini, the politician in question, wrestles themselves free to perform again
absolutely.
Another day.
Or can I just point out, if you're the right-wing press in Britain, a leader of an opposition party eats a bacon sandwich in a weird way.
Well, that's right. Yeah,
but yes, I do see your point. I think you know, an attack someone will be more likely to depose. Yeah,
but I also wonder whether there is an aspect. I don't know. I feel this. This would prevail in other countries. I don't know about our high moral tone here. I think many of us need to consider if we would avoid paying this sort of tax too, if we could, before we all explode.
Yes.
With, you know,
well, I have to say, I wouldn't. And you know, you can quote me on that if I'm a person of power and influence in 10 or 15 years' time. I absolutely wouldn't. I mean, I know a lot of people that wouldn't. But having said that, going back to the 2015 general election, nobody I knew voted. Well, I didn't know of anybody that voted Conservative and they won. So you know, you could but well be right. The thing that I think might do for Cameron over this, if he'd just come out and said on the first day, yes, I did have shares in this. If he just played it with a straight bat, I think it might have been all right. But the thing that makes me think it might not be all right for him now is, yes, we might all think, oh, well, you know, yes, maybe I'd have done the same thing. I was absent in position. But he looks like he's been dishonest now, because he could have said early on, and it's taken 2 or 3 days of poking and poking and poking for him to go, well, yeah, actually, I did benefit from it. And that's the wriggling.
Yeah, the wriggling looks very, very bad.
It does. Well, who knows? I might be completely wrong. And, you know, who knows? Maybe Jeremy Corbyn will be Prime Minister by Christmas. And I'll just have the rest of this beer.
This next song, I love this song from the first piano notes through Jerry Wexler's immaculate production, the soaring middle eight to the fade at 3 minutes, 26 seconds. It's the most joyous breakup song you'll ever hear. It's Aretha Franklin and Until You Come Back to Me. Co-written by Stevie Wonder, number 26 in the UK, number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100 from the winter of 1973, Aretha Franklin and Until You Come Back to Me.
Well, I did not know that that was co-written by Stevie Wonder, so you've taught me something about that song that I didn't know.
Oh, yeah. While many people of, I'm afraid I must say, dubious intelligence took to social media.
Well, shocker. People have limited social intelligence on socialmedia.com.
Hard to believe, yes. But it happened. Last Sunday afternoon to berate poor Ben Stokes.
Man, yes.
For his bowling that led to Carlos Braithwaite hitting 4 sixes off successive balls in the last over to win the 2020 Cricket World Cup for the West Indies. While that was going on, the rest of us were just left open-mouthed in admiration for the cool, yet I feel sort of adrenaline-charged way that the game was changed in the space of 2 minutes. Most extraordinary thing. There's a part of me that doesn't want to join in with the razzmatazz of the 2020 format, but I was completely entranced by this 2020 World Cup, and it's now It's extraordinarily popular around the world, especially in India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and of course, the West Indies. Just a quick sentence of explanation for non-cricketing listeners.
which there must be a few.
Yeah, just in a sentence. A full test match, for example, between England and Australia, runs for 5 days in theory. And the expectation is that 90 overs are bowled each of those days. So you're going to have 450 overs, six balls in each over, split between the two sides. But in 2020 cricket, each side bowls, not surprisingly, 20 overs, and the whole match is over within a couple of hours. 2020 is taking over, Jules. Is it all leading to the end of the traditional game?
Who knows? It's certainly interesting. I'm very amused by the fact that us here in England have to do really well in a sport before we would accept it as being legitimate, won't we, really? So everyone now loves 2020 cricket because we were all expected...
We got to the final.
Exactly. We were all expected to be rubbish or 2020 cricket. We were all expecting to be pants at it. And actually, respect to Morgan and Andrew Strauss and all of the England setup because, you know, they built an incredible team that... You know, and I do feel very, very sorry for poor old Ben Stokes because he'd had a fantastic tournament until then. And that chap that was his name, Braithwaite, did you say? That knocked all the runs off him. You know, it was his sort of best innings ever, I think. They said that, you know, I don't think he'd ever hit an innings like that. I don't think he'd ever hit an innings as big as those four balls, I don't think. So it was just one of those, you know, slightly unbelievable moments. But my dad always calls any form of cricket that isn't test cricket, pyjama cricket. Because of their uniforms. I also am very amused by my friend that now calls one day internationals 50-50 cricket, which perhaps they should have been called that anyway. I can see her logic, given that the other one's 2020, isn't it? But I don't know. I mean, there is something very, very idiosyncratic and weird about test cricket, isn't there? We've talked about the disadvantage for me and the advantage for you of 2020 cricket is that there is no time for a picnic. So, you're a happier person and I'm hungry and distraught. The olden days cricket, the test cricket, I remember someone saying to me once, I think it was an ex-girlfriend, when I was watching cricket, said, I don't understand how you can watch this where they can play for 5 days solidly and still have no result at the end of it. There is something a bit weird about that. It does hark back, I think, to a day when... We could talk about class in cricket as well, but leaving that to one side, it does hark back to days when people weren't terribly busy with other things in their lives and you didn't have to go to work necessarily and you could just spend 5 days sat watching cricket. I don't have that kind of life now and I know an awful lot of people that like cricket like me that don't either. So in a way, I suppose it's time management, isn't it, 2020? I think we've talked about this before with other things. You know, to what extent... Do you modify, to what extent are people right? To what extent are the general public never wrong about things being popular? And to what extent do we think it's you know, the faster culture in which we live now and whether that's a good or bad thing? I don't know. I think there's a place for all formats, personally, which might crucially be unfashionable. But I think players like Kevin Peterson, who we might well have seen the last of now for various personality-based reasons, show that you can be successful at all different things. And actually, I remember my dad watching Kevin Peterson batting in a test once and saying to me, well, he's a product of this modern short overs game. And actually, Kevin Peterson had, and again, Morgan and people like that, had enormous success at test cricket, despite being, you know, quote unquote, short game players. So I would not like to see any forms die out. I think 2020 is tremendously exciting. Being a moderate, which is obviously a bad thing in certain parts of the Labour Party nowadays, but being a moderate with a capital M, I quite like one day cricket because I think that's you know, you get enough room for the game to breathe, and it's not, there's a danger that 2020 becomes a one dimensional a smash fest and you kind of lose other skills that, you know, that particular skill is prized above all others. However, you know, so I wouldn't like those skills, you know, to be lost. I think there's room for all three formats of the game. I liked 50, you know, I like 50-50, to use my friend's term, cricket, because it's a bright balance between having a game that's sort of got a bit of a storyline and, you know, there still being time for it to swing one way or the other. And equally, you know, having exciting bursts of play and that sort of thing. So I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, the trend is moving towards shorter overs games as it is moving towards shorter bite-sized chunks of everything in life, but who knows?
That's very true. I mean, in terms of popularity, and I don't mean it in a disparaging way when I say it isn't really cricket in the traditional sense, because I'm lucky enough to be able to spend some sunny days at Lord's during the summer, usually watching Middlesex mooch along in a four-day county game. And I have to confess that for all its charm and oldie-worldie appeal, it's very rare to have the moments of heart-stopping drama that Carlos Braithwaite brought to us last weekend. And nor indeed, I have to confess, does it draw the crowds. Lord's has a capacity of 30,000, and I'm watching a county match along with maybe a few hundred fellow spectators seated around the ground, and 2020 games at Lord's for Middlesex sell out.
Oh, really? Gosh, that is that. And I think it's similar. My team is Sussex, and I think the Sussex Sharks games, they have night games. And again, you know, maybe that's an indication of people that work. I probably wouldn't be able to get a day off work to go and watch, you know, go to Hove to watch Sussex play, you know, 3-4 days in a county match. Having said that, I could easily drive over to Brighton in an evening and watch the Sussex Sharks play in the evening and then get home in time for work the next day.
Well, in terms of, you know, what it's going to mean for the future, I don't know what the answer is. You've said you don't know what the answer is, but rather, more importantly, I suspect rather strongly that the cricket authorities don't know either, and that's perhaps where cricket's conundrum lies for the future.
It'd be interesting what happens. And, you know, again, I like all forms of the game. And, and you know, obviously, if we planned this, probably we would have had 10cc dreadlock holiday now, wouldn't we? I don't like cricket. I love it. But instead, yeah, we'll go elsewhere, won't we?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're wondering if it's time to put the X Factor out of its misery. That's right after this, which is not from 10cc. It's from the Go Team.
Was Brighton's finest, again with Brighton coming up, the Go Team, which is sort of a kind of not exactly a one-man band, but a project run by a chap called Ian Parton. There are six of them at the moment, I think, and it's sort of a slightly revolving cast. That, in true Juliet is an Indie fan style, was actually a B-side, or rather a one-off single slash additional track on the second CD that came with their 2007 album Proof of Youth. I saw them at Latitude Festival in 2008 when they were sort of still touring that, and I didn't know much about them. They completely blew me away, particularly when they played that, which was, I think, one of the first times they played it. And, you know, they were just such fun. They had a teeny tiny singer called Ninja, who was about 5 foot and had this massive afro and tiny hot pants on, and just bounced all the way around, well, all of Suffolk, I think, during this set. And you know, they were really great. And they're still going. They're still releasing albums. I think not to quite as big an audience. But I just think that sometimes it's nice to have some good old fashioned sort of Technicolor Dayglow fun in your life, really, isn't it?
I'm surprised the Go Team haven't broken through elsewhere in the world. I mean, they've had some success in Japan, I believe.
Yes, which they're so sort of Japanese sound, aren't they?
So really? Set up for that. But I think I've always expected them to break through in America, because their sound seems absolutely made for top 40 radio in the USA. So that's an odd one.
I can see it going well on sort of alternative America. College radio, I'm surprised.
College radio would love them.
Absolutely, yeah, which is weird. Yeah. But anyway, long live the Go Team.
Long live the Go Team, indeed. There's really no argument that Simon Cowell took over a successful format when X Factor replaced Pop Idol here in the UK in 2004, it was. And it's been equally popular all around the world. It's been franchised out from countries from Albania to Vietnam. But perhaps tellingly, many countries have dropped it from their TV schedule in the last couple of years. Here in the UK, judges have come and gone. Some have made an impact, some less so. Don't mention Nick Grimshaw. And presenters have come and gone with equally mixed results. This week, it was announced that former host Dermot O'Leary is to return for the 13th season this autumn. Now, this has got to be the last roll of the dice, really, Jules, for a show that is beginning to feel like an unwelcome party guest who just won't go home.
It does feel a little bit like that. I mean, speaking of formats of X Factor around the world, I've always rather enjoyed the Welsh version, which is called Wow Factor, which I think is but WAWF, I think. singer Duffy, sometimes singer Duffy, I think, was a finalist on Wow Factor, which is the only reason why I've heard of it. But alas, I digress. There was a second sort of vaguely related point in this that has made me laugh a lot this week. Speaking of judges going, Cheryl Cole has announced her departure again from X Factor, apparently. A friend of mine managed to mash through two news stories rather brilliantly when we were talking about the Panama stuff earlier. This has been the front page on every newspaper except the Daily Express, which decided to put a headline about the possible potential health dangers of walnuts instead. That was their big news story. Yes. And one of my friends put sarcastically, I wonder what's happened with that walnut story on his Facebook. To which another one of our particularly sarcastic friends commented underneath, well, Cheryl's left the X Factor, walnut related, I believe. So who knows if Cheryl Cole's departure was walnut related, Panama related, or indeed other related.
The Express are mad on health stories.
They are. They're even worse than the Mail, aren't they?
Every other day, the Express has got a story about, you know, walnuts cure arthritis, or eating sponge fingers
makes you fly. Absolutely. It's crazy. But they have a sort of a three-pronged attack on sensible news stories, which is, oh my gosh, we're all going to be snowed in forever.
Diana conspiracies.
Well, I was going to say, will this salmon give you X-ray vision, and or will this tin of beans kill you? And as the Private Eye once beautifully summed it up, was Princess Diana's death caused by a fall in ham prices, in house prices? So yes, the you know, God bless the Express and all its sale in their walnutty goodness. But going back to what you actually asked me about, which is X-Factor. Fair enough, yeah, the X Factor. It's felt like a sort of a they've been flogging a dead horse for ages, really. And I wonder if it's not just X Factor, the voice that they've bought the voice off BBC, which seems to be a rather out there decision, really, considering the ITV have almost said to themselves, well, we clearly don't know what the hell to do with X Factor anymore. So I tell you what, let's have two things of exactly the same nature that we don't know what on earth to do with. That will make things a lot better. For me, it feels like it died ages ago. I mean, it's the problem is that the carrot of the programme, You'll Have a Chart Career, has so obviously been exposed as being a sham now, hasn't it? I mean, you're almost, you know, you get an album out just about, but you know, you're only a year away from being back singing in wine bars again, aren't you? So I mean, it's not really, you know, the dream is dead. Long live the dream. It's not really working anymore. And like you say, whatever they seem to do doesn't seem to fix it. So they got rid of Louis Walsh. That didn't work. They brought Cheryl back. That didn't work. You know, they changed the presenters. Ollie Murr seemed to want to tell people what the result was before people had voted. I mean, I did feel sorry for him with that, but it did rather, you know, tin-hatted conspiracy theorists everywhere were very much helped by that, weren't they? Everyone tried to care about Caroline Flack and somehow couldn't. I mean, it does feel like it's kind of, you know, like you say, I thought this year would be the last year, actually. I thought the rumours were, you know, it was, considering it was beaten by the Antiques Roadshow one Sunday night, apparently, in the viewing figures, which surely is the death knell. But, like you say, I think it's, you know, it's gone, really, isn't it? I can't see it having a, you know, obviously if it lived by its own rules, it would have an amazing comeback, wouldn't it? It would, you know, would have a number one single all over again. But actually, I just can't. And they've messed with the format so much. I mean, my mum watches it, and if I'm round there, I watch a little bit of it, and I feel that one has to, much like a high court judge, one has to watch these things, that you know what's going on. And when our secretaries have chats, I can at least pretend that I know what's happening. And the most popular bit seemed to be judges' houses, and I used to find this quite interesting from a psychological perspective, where you've had all the kind of, you know, Victorian tomato throwing rounds at the beginning. Mm. And then you're left with quite a lot of people who are really quite good. And you need to sift the kind of good, really good, from just the good. So in the past, a judge would get down to, I don't know, a final 10 or whatever, or a small amount of people. And they would go to the judge's house, which, because they are the judges, are usually, you know, in normal stately homes or you know, pristine apartments in penthouses in big cities, that sort of thing. And then they would all sing in front of they would ooh and ah at the front room, and then they would sing. And actually, I used to find that really interesting. And I think a lot of people did, because there's sort of a psychology behind it. I thought it was fascinating who they plumped for. If everyone's good, what are they looking for? What do they think will appeal? What is their, you know, what are they betting the barn on, really? And I found that bit of it quite interesting. And they scrapped that a couple of years ago and didn't have it anymore. And you just think, well, if you don't even know the strengths, and I'm not just saying this because I liked it, you know, a lot of people that chat about it at work say, oh, why don't they have judges' houses anymore? So it seems like even the parts of the format that they were successful, they sort of lost sight of how to win, basically. So
well, perhaps we, you know, you're right in saying we've all simply had enough of these going to make you a star TV reality shows. Because I was thinking, you know, maybe 20 years ago, you couldn't turn on the television without finding some fey young fellow ruining a family's dining room. You know, by nailing MDF panels all over the walls and calling it design.
Absolutely. And then someone crying over a leopard print covered front room.
Absolutely. And then 10 years ago, humourless, smirky people were sticking decking and water features into backyards. And
people digging stuff up without any bras on. Yeah, I remember that. Yes.
All of that. And perhaps now, you know, the country has just simply had its fill of Simon Cowell and his, I don't like it, I love
yes,
it.
Yes, indeed.
You know, all that bants.
And you're going to be a star. Yes.
All of that.
Yes.
When you look at the winners of the last four seasons of The X Factor,
I can't even remember who they are, to be honest. Who on earth are
they? I'll tell you. James Arthur.
Oh,
Sam
yes, he's
Bailey.
The man that said all those terrible, sweary things and was massively homophobic. Sam Bailey is the lady that's now apparently taken
in Chicago.
Yes, she's in Chicago. So I suppose she has etched some sort of career in stage musicals, which is, you know, not to be sniffed at. She wouldn't have had that opportunity otherwise.
Ben Hay now.
Oh, the chat with the strange hair that spells his surname in a needlessly elaborate way.
Exactly. And the most recent winner, Louisa Johnson.
Who is a girl, I think. That's what I can tell you about Louisa
Well,
Johnson.
They haven't set the world aflame, have
Perhaps
they?
I mean,
I think we're both saying good luck to Dermot, but...
Yes, I like
Dermot
a lot, actually. I think
harmless fellow. Harmless sort of chap.
And my mum always is at pains to say that he is very kind to the contestants when things go well or badly. He's very nice, and we like that. I do think his Radio 2 show on Saturdays is a bit blander than my taste usually allow, but he does seem like a decent chap. So we wish Dermot well in his latest multi-million-pound venture.
Yes, even though he may be trying to climb aboard a sinking
ship.
Yes,
indeed.
You could contact us if you like. The best way is through Twitter. At SuperJules84 is my lovely colleague Juliet.
Hello.
And I'm at Sir Terrence.
Which is far more urbane as ever.
Yes. Jules, no doubt you'll be appearing here and there, everywhere across various forms of media.
Yes,
over the
indeed.
Next...
Media saturation. That's me. I'm synergizing all over the shop. It's mostly radio, as ever. I'll be doing the Saturday Social this week. Hooray.
Hooray. Oh, I love that.
You're a fan, aren't you? Which is always good news. Saturday, the 9th of April. Your Aretha Franklin knowledge earlier, Miss, you could sit in for me if ever needed. I would be happy to hand the keys to the social over to you. But it would 6 till 7 on Barricade Radio, Saturday evening. I'm doing this A to Z of Northern Soul, Motown, Modern, Miscellaneous, and we've reached D, so we'll be having lots of D on Saturday for an hour. And I'm also doing Indie Wonderland once again next Wednesday from 8 till 10 p.m. on Wednesday nights. You can catch us all at barricaderadio.com. I also have a Mixcloud channel, and I'm Juliet L. Harris on a Mixcloud, so you can find previous shows up on there.
Hurrah!
Hurrah!
Thanks to Rona, and thanks to you for listening. Of course, we'll be back next week. I really do think we've played some great music this week.
We've had a good run, haven't we? I feel.
Yeah, really good. I've really enjoyed them all, and I think our fourth and final track continues that theme. Another musician who's never quite broken through into the mainstream, despite writing hit singles for others, playing us out from his 1991 album Life's Too Short. This is Marshall Crenshaw and Fantastic Planet of Love.
The way you smile, even when heartbreak is closing in around you. Girl, you know that that's one thing I ought to learn how to do. Won't you hear my every time you smile, you make my world a fantastic planet of love. What new battle will this day bring? Just this morning, I felt my troubles fleeting. Believe me, darling, this is true. It's only when I'm next to you that I ever dream of fantastic planet of love. Right now I feel it, I feel something closing in around me. It's in the headlines of the tabloids, and I heard about it on TV. Come see about me, can't wait to be hanging around with the one who makes my world a fantastic planet of love. Don't get angry. Save your anger. You shouldn't look at it that way. Come over and I'll be satisfied. It's only when I'm by your side that I ever dream of a fantastic planet of love. Fantastic planet of love.
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.